Now, after World War II, the winds of nationalism were blowing through Asia and Africa, Latin America. And in Iran, nationalism meant one thing. We've got to take back control of our oil. At the beginning of the 20th century, through a corrupt deal with the declining Qajar dynasty, the British grabbed control of the entire Iranian oil industry. Even Winston Churchill, who was then First Lord of the Admiralty, said very accurately that this was a prize from fairyland beyond our wildest dreams. Mastery itself is the prize of the venture, is what he said. So all during the first half of the 20th century, the whole British economy was fueled by oil from Iran. Every factory in Britain was powered by oil from Iran. Every car and every Jeep was powered by Iranian oil. The Royal Navy, which projected British power all over the world, was fueled by oil from Iran. Britain has no oil, nor have any colonies that have oil. Everything was coming from Iran. By the period leading up to World War II, 90% of the oil being sold in Europe was coming from Iran. And all the profits were going to this one British company. So you had this situation where a poor country, whose miserable people were living in some of the worst conditions of any people in the world, had an enormously valuable resource which was going to prop up the economy of a European country. So it was natural that when Iran emerged from World War II and became a real functioning democracy, that the leaders of Iran would reflect this great public clamor. We've got to take back control of our oil so we can use the profits to develop our own country. Well, naturally, the British were in a panic when they heard this. At first, they didn't believe it. One of their first orders was to ask their ambassador in Britain to approach Prime Minister Mossadegh or one of his aides and find out how much money does he really want us to put in his Swiss bank account so he can forget all this foolishness. But it turned out it wasn't just Mossadegh. It was the entire Iranian people. It wouldn't have even worked, even if you could have bribed the Prime Minister, because the entire people of Iran had grasped onto this cause. The British tried everything. They blockaded the port where the oil was exported from. They forced all their experts who could run the refinery to go back to Britain. And, of course, they'd been very careful not to train any Iranians in how to run that refinery. They prevented agricultural and manufactured goods from getting into Iran. They took Iran to the United Nations. They took Iran to the World Court. None of this worked. So the British finally decided we're going to have to overthrow the government of Iran. We're going to have to overthrow Prime Minister Mossadegh. They began to plan this, but Mossadegh found out what they were doing. And he did the only thing that he could have done to protect himself, which was he closed the British embassy. And he sent home all the British diplomats, including, of course, all the secret agents that were planning the coup. So now, the British were really in a panic. They were losing their most valuable, richest, most lucrative property anywhere in the world. To who? Iranians? It was a huge shock. And then what happened was Prime Minister Churchill decided the only hope for us is we've got to turn to the Americans and see if we can get the Americans to do this for us. So he approached President Truman, and Truman said, no, the CIA does not overthrow governments. And that was true. That was true at the time. The CIA had never overthrown a government up to that time. It was Truman's idea that it could be used for intelligence gathering, but not for that kind of operation. In fact, while I was researching this book in the Truman Library in Missouri, I found a fantastic phrase in one of Truman's letters when he was writing about the CIA. He was very worried about giving too much power to the CIA. And here's the phrase that he used to describe what he was afraid that the CIA might become. He said, American Gestapo. So Truman was very unwilling to use the CIA this way. Now the British were really in trouble. They had nothing. But then, at the end of 1952, the British Foreign Office and the Secret Service were electrified with the news that there had been an election in the United States. And a new group was coming into power. New president would be Dwight Eisenhower, and new Secretary of State would be John Foster Dulles, who had spent his entire life as the number one international corporate lawyer for big American companies. The roster of the clients that John Foster Dulles served is essentially just a list of all the giant multinational corporations of that era. So the idea that a country somewhere out there in the world was bothering a big, giant multinational corporation or a big British or American corporation was something that Dulles took very seriously. He didn't want that example to spread. So, finally, the Americans decided, we will do this. President Eisenhower and John Foster Dulles reversed the Truman policy. And they told the British, okay, we're going to do it for you. We're going to go over to Iran, and we're going to overthrow Prime Minister Mossadegh. And in the beginning of August 1953, a very intrepid CIA agent crossed over into Iran with the assignment, organized the overthrow of the government. And it's one of those wonderful quirks of history that the agent that was sent to Iran was Kermit Roosevelt, the grandson of Theodore Roosevelt, who had brought America into the regime change era back in the time of the Spanish-American War. Well, it only took Kermit Roosevelt 3 weeks to organize the overthrow of the democratic government of Iran. It didn't just mean the end of Prime Minister Mossadegh's rule. It meant the end of democracy in Iran.